Blog Talk Radio.
I stroll through the pictures, what I've left behind. You want again. I'm locked up in memories, they all intertwine. The memories in my mind. I know tomorrow, 'cause that dawn will come. You will never know just what you have done.
Good evening, and welcome to the Community Matters This Week show on the Blog Talk Radio Network, sponsored by Los Angeles Community Policing and the National Association of Adult Survivors of Child Abuse. My name is Bill Murray. I'll be your host this evening. I'm coming to you from Los Angeles, and I am myself an adult survivor of child abuse. Joining me in just a matter of moments will be a panel of people who will help me with the format of tonight's show, which basically is a discussion of the news of the week as it's appeared on our two websites. The two websites' names are lacp.org for Los Angeles Community Policing and nasca.org for the National Association of Adult Survivors of Child Abuse. Now, what you'll want to do is you'll want to call up one of those pages. The homepage from either website will do, because the format for tonight's show includes information that's linked off the front page of both websites. So select either one you want. The easiest one, perhaps, is lacp.org. To go to lacp.org, Los Angeles Community Policing, you will find in the top left corner, there's a graphic, and below that, a picture of a microphone. Next to the microphone, it says, in red letters, tonight, meaning tonight's show. Tonight's show being Community Matters This Week show, a discussion of the news of the week from lacp.org. Click that link once, and nasca.org. Click that link once. So I want you to click each of those two links one time, off the front page of either website. And as I said, on both websites, this link is available. It's always beside the microphone picture that you can find the topic for tonight's shows, any shows that we do six nights a week. So go to lacp.org or nasca.org, NAASCA.org. Find the microphone picture. Right beside it, it says tonight, and then it describes tonight's show as being Community Matters This Week, the news of the week from lacp.org. Click that once, and nasca.org, and click that once, and the correct pages will open up. Now, when they do open up, what you're going to see is the news of the week from February 25th to March 3rd is what you'll find on the LACP site. And then you'll find the final week, February, week four, off the NASCA website. And these two pages are what we'll use. The panel will tell us which page they want to have a discussion about, how far down the page the article they want to refer to appears, and, of course, the article's headline, to help us all be on the same articles all night long. And this is a two-hour show, so we'll take our time here, but let me bring on a couple of panelists tonight. First of all, my co-host, my usual co-host for Monday to Friday, all the shows that we do during the week, which are called Community, which are called Stop Child Abuse Now, is Carol Levine. Carol D. Levine, the author of Panic Child, The Harrowing True Story of Sexual Abuse and Neglect is available everywhere, including at Amazon. And Carol Levine calls in from Northwest New Jersey, opposite, across the Delaware River from Easton, Pennsylvania. Hi, Carol. How are you tonight?
Oh, I'm fine, Bill. Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
I'm glad to have you, too. And we have MJ with us, and, of course, I'm referring to MJ Goings. MJ is the person that's most responsible, actually, for the majority of the articles that appear on the websites each day. She does the research for them when she gets home from work because she's the shift supervisor as a registered nurse at the county hospital where she lives. And she works the night shift. She comes home in the mornings, and before she does anything else, she does the research that she then sends to me that I turn into the web pages. And then ultimately I turn them into weekly web pages, and that's how we get this work to be done here. MJ Goings is a longtime volunteer with both LACP and NASCA, virtually since their inception, and a very good friend of mine from rural Ohio. Hi, MJ. How you doing?
Hi, Bill. I'm doing okay tonight. You doing okay tonight? You sound a little off.
You sound off?
Yeah.
No, I'm fine.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. How do I sound off?
Just a little short of breath tonight.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, well, I'll try to catch my breath.
Okay.
There's one more panel member now calling in, and I'll bring him on. This is Jay Tao, who is another friend of mine. Jay, however, is from another part of the country. He's from the Fort Lauderdale, Florida area, and he is a counselor and a life coach and a certified sexologist who has worked for many years, a couple decades, in the Fort Lauderdale area. Immediately he has an office there. But he also works online, and you should look up his services by checking out his website at alttherapist.org, with two T's, alttherapist.org, where you will find that Jay not only works with people in, as I say, his home office, but he also works with them online by using Skype. And Jay's been doing this quite some time. He is calling in tonight, as he does every night, every Sunday night, to offer his two cents and his expertise in terms of his experience as the certified sexologist and a member of the mental health community, basically. Hi, Jay. How you doing?
Good evening. Good evening. I had a hard time getting into the chat room today.
Well,
My normal way of getting on just didn't, and then it said live, so I clicked on that, and gee, it opened up.
Okay. Well, I see we're all in there, so we did all get there. I'm sorry if it's taking a little bit of time. What Jay's referring to is the fact that with every show that we do at Blog Talk Radio, our grassroots organization always runs a chat room. Now, that's an option for a producer, but the way we've set up our organization is that we want to be as inclusive as possible in everything we do. So among the things we can offer is a chat room during our shows. It is better if you have a screen name at Blog Talk Radio. That's the way to participate in a chat room, because then when you're logged in, instead of being called a guest, you'll come in under that screen name, and that allows you to type back and forth to people. Otherwise, you can only read what other people are typing, and the whole point is to engage with you. So do come into our chat room under a logged-in screen name at Blog Talk Radio, and you'll be all set. We always the show always includes chat room participation, as we always include, at least during some part of the shows, and tonight right from the very top of the show, our call-in number, which is a direct number dedicated to our show, which is 646-595-2118. 646-595-2118. When you call that number, you'll hear the show on your phone. And at any time that you want to join our conversation, you'll get instructions when you join the show by phone that if you want to talk, you push number one more time. And it raises a little symbol that lets me know to open the microphone that's associated with somebody's phone line here. And we just bring you on the air. To join our discussion tonight, which, of course, is, again, the News of the Week show, from both LACP.org and NASCA.org. Now, the panelists all know to look ahead and pick out a few things to get our show launched, but even before I ask them that, I wonder if there's anything on their mind that they'd like to do that's not on the pages. Anybody have an issue that they'd like to discuss or get off their chest? No? Okay. Then we'll go ahead and start our show in our normal format. As I say, is for panelists to select which page they want to go from first, then tell us how far down the page the article appears, and then finally the headline of the article, so we can all be on the same article at the same time, same page, same time, literally. And who would like to go first?
Well, I got one. You know me. I'm always ready with one.
Go ahead. Yep.
On the NASCA site, about fourth of the way down. This is something I just never thought of, and I don't know why. We've never discussed it. It's out of North Carolina. Sex traffickers could be added to the sex offender registry. I guess for me, it was almost like, well, duh. I don't know why we've just not brought that issue up. They obviously should be added to the registry, in my mind. What do you guys think?
Yeah.
Looking for the article.
Yeah. It's a small one. It's right here, and I see it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we've just never even approached that topic. We've never discussed whether they are or whether they aren't on the registry. I'm thinking, why haven't we? Why has that never come up before? But if this is something that they're just now starting to talk about in different states, I think more states need to jump on the bandwagon, because definitely anybody involved in sex trafficking, you know, of children should be put on the offender list.
Absolutely.
I'm having trouble finding the article, to be honest, MJ. You said it's a quarter of the way down?
Yeah.
Really? Okay. What's the title of the article, please, the headline?
Sex traffickers could be added to sex offender registry.
Okay. All right, well, talk a little bit about what a sex offender registry is and what normally goes there and so forth. So we understand your reason for being surprised that they're not there already.
It's the seventh article down, by the way.
That doesn't make sense to me. When they commit such crimes like that, why wouldn't they be on the registry? I don't get it. You know, it does say here that they'll have to wear ankle bracelets and monitoring. Okay, when they are on the registry, they are reported to the counties in which they live. Their neighbors will know who they are. They'll have to wear ankle bracelets and monitoring. Well, duh.
But somebody should talk. You know, we have to assume that people who are joining us are not knowledgeable, and we have to explain what these things mean. What is a sex registry? Would be an example. Something we had to explain in order to say why we were upset that they weren't included. So what is a sex registry, sex offender registry?
Well, that's when you have to go and sign in because you're a sex offender.
When you've been convicted of a sexual crime.
Right.
You are to register with your, most of it is your town, your city, whether it be your county. There's a list of convicted offenders. This is the registry for that particular area.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so what it is it's a requirement once you're convicted of an offense and your offense rises to a certain level that you must be designated and as a registered sex offender. The registry is where your name shows up.
Mm-hmm.
It's done state by state or locale by locale. There's no national database for this. But the states, each one in turn has its own method of trying to keep track of who they know of that's at least a level 2 offender or worse. And you may or may not be required to stay on that registration, be a sex offender, registered sex offender, for the rest of your life. Some people get off of it eventually, Many people don't. So it is kind of a designation that people who are caught obviously would like to avoid, you know, getting involved with, or would like to get off of if they ever get on it. It causes all kinds of problems for registered sex offenders because you're required to not only to do the checking in, it's kind of like a parole system, basically, mm-hmm. in a lot of places for sex offenders. I mean, some of them are also required to wear ankle bracelets and so forth, too, but most of the time it's a requirement to live in a certain situation, a certain distance away from children is often involved, or schools or parks or all of that, or churches, and to show up at this parole officer's office on a regular basis to check in. So that's what a registered sex offender is. So
mm-hmm.
what is a sex trafficker? What is a sex trafficker? Sex trafficker is someone who by coercion takes advantage. They don't have to actually take you very far in order to be trafficking, but they have to, by against your will, put you to work in the trade, in the sexual active trade, usually as a prostitute or a streetwalker. Sometimes male prostitution, for example, can happen too. But that's a person who essentially holds you against your will. So basically, I think a lot of pimps could be called sex traffickers. But obviously also a lot of people are moved from place to place to place against their will. Sometimes even internationally, they're taken from one country to another. But that doesn't have to be part of it. You can be, you know, simply held against your will or by coercion, forced to do sex acts on behalf of your trafficker, who makes most of the money off of it, obviously, and that would be a sex trafficker.
Okay.
So they're two different things, right? But I'm amazed. Okay. Well, I don't know.
Jay,
you want to chime in? Everybody else has talked a little.
I'm listening. You're doing fine.
A pimp to me,
yeah.
Bill, when a pimp is caught, okay, certainly he should go on the registry. He's pimping girls out, so therefore he's a sex offender, and that to me is a person that belongs on the registry.
Well, I have a feeling that every state lists offenses that would fall under sex offender, and
mm-hmm.
maybe that kind of fell through. Yeah, sex offense, sex trafficking.
Mm-hmm.
Trafficking people has become more of an issue in recent years. Sex offenders have been an issue that have been discussed for a significant number of years. So you know, this is like catching up. This is the new issue, and probably in a lot of states, it's not part of the registry. You know, it's not part of what's considered as one of the offenses that would require them to be on the sex offenders list.
Hmm.
You know, so it's going to, you know, state by state, they're going to have to go back and adjust their definition.
Okay, now that's significant what you just said, because the consciousness of sex trafficking is only a recent thing. Well, we've had a consciousness about sex trafficking when we think of taking people from one country to another for a little while. The concept of sex trafficking being something that can be much more local and much more, it's a national problem, is just being recognized. And we're starting to use the word sex trafficker to describe anybody who takes advantage of anybody else for the purpose of putting them to work in the sex trade by coercion or against their will. That's pretty much not a legal definition, but a generally understood definition, becoming more and more understood, but it's a brand new concept for our country to think of ourselves as even having a sex trafficking trade. It's been there all along, but we're starting to call prostitutes who are held against their will, at least underage ones, you know, child
victims.
Victims, yes. And we're trying to describe the victims, the child prostitutes as victims now. We're starting to describe the pimps and the Johns as the criminals. And in terms of the pimps, who they're the ones that would be called sex traffickers. Of course, the John is the market. Without the market, you wouldn't have the trade. But there's always been the market, and there's always been the trade. I mean, they don't have. There is no unification of any of this stuff. That's part of. We have talked certainly about this, MJ, as you know. That part of the problem is that you can be a sex offender in one place and kind of drop off the radar simply because you've moved to another portion of the country, and pop up there using a different name, or even a slightly different name, and go about your life without being on the radar at all. So, and there's no way to share this information from state to state. There's no national database. And the majority of the databases, from our understanding, according to people who have dealt with them and have done research on them, are broken. And they're broken in the sense that they either contain people that shouldn't be there, or they don't contain people that should be there, or they list people who are no longer there. Many of them are not accurate in many shapes and forms. So, but I agree, MJ, that the ideal situation would be to come up with a standard definition of the criminal element that deals in the sex trade. Mm-hmm. And make them and have a national database for all of them, and maybe we could, if we needed to, we could list them in different categories, obviously.
Right.
But it should be inescapable that somebody who, just because they're in North Carolina, could possibly move to Nevada and never have his record follow him.
Right.
Simply because he moved from one state to another.
As we say, it's imperative that we get somebody on the ball in Washington to make these laws national laws,
mm-hmm.
not just jurisdiction by jurisdiction, state by state. That just makes no sense.
The kicker of it is every jurisdiction has some version of tracking sex offenders, registering and tracking sex offenders, every state. But they're not talking to each other, and there's no uniformity of it. So that's become very frustrating to us who work to fight against child abuse. And as we've mentioned many times before, we recognize this problem got resolved to some degree in the world of public safety, at least at a certain point, they established a DNA database called CODIS. I don't think sexual offenders are part of the DNA database. I don't believe they are. But in any case, what we discovered when CODIS came about and it was started and it became a national resource, that every convicted felon's DNA, violent convicted felon's DNA, went in the database. Then we resolved a lot of crimes that we didn't know were being committed by the same person, and at the same time, we exonerated a lot of people who have been convicted when the DNA database showed that they couldn't possibly have been the perpetrator of the crime they were convicted for, and they were released. Some of them even from death row.
Yeah.
Over 100, I believe, from death row. So, to me, I don't know why they just don't take a swab and add it in the database, but it hasn't happened yet. I think there's also a lack of a consciousness about the seriousness of these problems to some areas. It's just not a big deal at all. It's kind of not. It's not being complained about. Maybe it's not being reported. So it's not. We know every state in the union has sex offenders and children who are being abused, sexually assaulted. But I think some states are much more sensitive to it than others at this point. And again, there's no there's no national sense of outrage about this at all, which is a shame.
Mm-hmm. Right.
All righty.
That's all I had to say is, ugh.
Thank you for your comment.
I think once it's made an economic problem, maybe it'll get more, viewed as an economic problem. What it's costing us as a nation,
right.
I think it'll probably get more attention.
And for that reason, we do try to repeat frequently during the week the cost that we know, not that we know, but that comes from the government's own statistics. According to the Center for Disease Control, is $120 billion a year,
mm-hmm.
To deal with issues involving childhood sexual assault. That's a lot of money, $124 billion. When you look at it a slightly different way, and you take the lifelong costs of 1 year's worth of abused kids, again, the CDC's figure is $585 billion. Over a lifetime of costs associated with 1 year's worth of assaulted children. And, of course, that is a statistic that repeats every year, because every year, 1 year, 1 year more of children become adults. So that's the true cost. The kind of money that would be needed to institute a national effort, compared to those kinds of numbers, is minuscule, and would save us a lot of, ultimately, those billions, billions and billions we're talking about. And we're not even, I would argue that it's really more an effort to coordinate and put out a clear message than anything else, and that's not that expensive. We already have plenty of institutions, federal institutions, and other and nonprofits and hospitals and medical studies and universities that are doing studies that have, there's tons of information available. It's just not collected. It's not offered back out in a succinct way. There's no unification of it. And,
Well, now we have to be realistic here, though. When you talk about money and how much it costs, you know, we do have more important things than child abuse.
I hear sarcasm coming. Go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, we have the endangered owl in Washington, and we have some species of fish in Lake Erie that, you know, they're spending millions and billions of dollars on. Those have to take precedence over our children. Now, come on.
Yeah, right. I get so angry, MJ. You know, I just really do. I don't know what people have to do, to make this more of an issue. However, as long as there's people like us on this show, and there's not enough of us, all right, but there are some of us for sure, that go out there and speak their mind and say what we say about child abuse and why it is such a big issue, I'm hoping that in time there will be a difference. But it's going to take time. But that's okay. I'm going to be out there. You bet. They just it just makes me so angry because, like, again, going back to the debates, nothing was mentioned about child abuse. But a little bit about schooling, education. You're right. Bill said that, and that's true. But not about child abuse. And it just has to stop. People have to just get with it. I do have another article here if you want to move on.
Okay. Where would you like to go?
Okay. I want to go to one that I think sounds positive, though. And at the end, it says you can contact this person, and you just know I'm going to. I don't know where it'll come from, but we'll see what happens. This guy is three down, okay, and this is on the NASCA site. And,
okay.
It kind of triggered me as I was reading it. Ruben Rosario, today I need to tell you about a little boy.
Right.
Now, MJ, this is a wonderful article.
I thought so too, Carol. And that's one reason I always include the contact information for people that write these articles. If it's available, I put it in there.
Well, that's good because I'm going to contact him. I'd love to have him on our show. Okay, Ruben Rosario. The little boy, no more than seven, knew what was coming when the orange drapes were drawn in the bedroom window on the ground floor in the Bronx apartment of Ho Avenue. It was icky. It was going to be painful. But this was his 15-year-old primo, Hermano, a first cousin who was like a big brother to a little boy who had no siblings and no father present at the time. And at the end, sometimes, but not always, the little boy would be given a quarter, as long as he promised not to tell. Okay. And he'd go buy, you know, candy, whatever, and then he'd go out in the streets and he'd play with his friends. That little boy had no clue that he was being raped and molested. I am that little boy. This is what he's saying. I was and am still that little boy. You see, that little boy never really grows up. You don't get over it. And it goes on about that in this article here, too. I decided last week, more than half a century later, to publicly bear what I should have told someone decades ago. I do this now so much for me, or not for me. I'm doing it for all the little boys and girls across the state, across the nation, across the world, who are being abused. And so he writes his story somewhat. If you are a child dealing with this or an adult who knows of such abuse, overcome the fear, go outside the family if you have to, and tell someone you trust. We talk about this on the show all the time. Don't wait the way that I did. A year of abuse at age seven, child sexual abuse is an epidemic that in recent years has gradually, thankfully, shed some of its stigma, this is what he says, for victims, and drawn some light through high-profile cases like the clergy pedophilia scandal and the recent Penn State University molestation cases. The stats are sobering, and of course we all know this. This guy says that in Minnesota, 17,690 of the 61,000 reported cases of sexual assault involved a child victim. And the overwhelming majority of cases throughout the years, upward of 80%, according to some studies, involve an abuser who is either a relative or a close family friend known to the victim. Then throw in the fact that this is the most underreported of crimes. No matter what form it takes, this kind of abuse is sick and evil. And that's exactly how I feel about it, and you do too, Bill, sick and evil. There is no justification for it, but I would argue that when an abuser is a relative, and this is where I come in, I was getting triggered left and right, but when the abuser is a relative, the dynamics are messier, more complex, and a bigger barrier for a child to overcome. Or to come forward, I should say, than if the abuser was from the outside, from the family circle. In my case, I had both. Part of this is what you don't have. You don't have a safe place. You have no place to go. If it happens at home, it would be good if you could go to school, to a psychologist, okay? And if, you know, where are you going to go, right? If it's happening at a school or a church, hopefully, then you can go back home and escape. So this is why a kid needs a safe place to go. Hunter says child victims are three times as likely to be abused by a family member as by a stranger. Although my memory of time is hazy, I believe my abuse occurs several times over the course of a year or so. So with him it was a few times. One time is too many. At the time, my divorced mother and I had moved in with an aunt, and because we could not afford our own place, and that's why this was going on. That's why his cousin was able to assault him. Then it says, memories buried, not gone. And this is why I always say I put in a different part of my brain. Like most victims, that's what I do. That's what I did. Like most victims, I disassociated, myself from child abuse. I tried hard to believe it never happened. I tucked it deep into the remote corner, forgot about it, and moved on with my life. Now, this man, he excelled academically, he graduated from college, he got married, raised two kids, worked at being a success. My abuser got married and had two kids. I don't believe he abused others, but I don't really know. And that still haunts this man, because he doesn't know. I never confronted him, and he never talked about it at the family gatherings. His presence would trigger him, you can be sure of that. I always felt at fault for my victimization. See, he felt like he was, the one causing this. I allowed him to do it, right? Hey, I got a quarter. I got a quarter for doing it. I did not want to break my aunt's heart or my mother's heart by coming out. I did not want to stir up a past that would surely sever the family relationships. And I thought that, as an unpleasant as it was, I had to come out and pretty, well, he ended up coming out to his wife. He ended up telling his wife. He said, I was wrong. Like many, I self-medicated at times to kill the pain. I drank quite a bit through college, but since everybody else was drinking, he figured that was okay. But he knew later on that it wasn't. And he would have his dark, cloudy moods. He had all kinds of mood swings. Well, I can certainly go along with all this. But I shrugged that, he just shrugged it off. Now, a revelation after death. The tucked away memory surfaced with a vengeance the year that I was informed that my abuser was diagnosed with leukemia. I thought I had forgiven him of what he had done, but I really had not. It triggered bouts of binge drinking and episodes where I would fly into a rage at my wife or kids at some slight of disagreement. This is what people do when they don't tell, with the men especially. They take it out on their family. I busted a few doors in my home. With his fists, he did this. It was then that I confided in my wife, and I told her, and he was married for 16 years, and she started connecting the dots, as I call it. She made the connection between the abuse and the behavior, concerned about his drinking and so forth, and he had a stepfather that was good to him. He did tell his stepfather, and his stepfather was really upset. Now, the very sad part of this is this man, too, is ill, but he has cancer, but at least it's treatable. He says, another barrier for me beyond self-inflicted shame and guilt is that this subject is super taboo in the Latino culture. He's Latin. But in telling the stories of other child victims through my columns over the years, I've learned that there is nothing more macho than having the courage to come forward, and there is nothing more important than having a trusted confidant. That, in his case, was his wife. She had been his therapist, his consoler, his advisor, and his shoulder to lean on for years. Then there are fellow survivors whose courage also gave me the motivation to tell you what I'm telling you now. There's a 16-year-old Bloomington girl I wrote about 21 years ago, the one who stood before a packed courtroom, confronted her abuser, and then insisted, with her father's blessings, that I identify her by her name in the column. There are numerous prostituted females who shared their stories of sexual abuse at home and how they sought to find love and affection through the men who pimped them out. And then there's Al Chesley, the former NFL player and fellow childhood sex abuse survivor, who came here this past week to testify in favor of a bill to eliminate statute of limitations for child sexual abuse victims. I embrace and celebrate now that little abused boy, meaning himself, who will always live inside me. I'm not ashamed of him anymore. He is no longer dumb or stupid. I thank him for helping me to be nobody's fool, to develop a healthy skepticism about human nature that has served me well in my chosen profession, and to be more empathetic and passionate about this and other issues and the plight of others. As Chesney so eloquently put it last week, I nurture him now. I give him a lot of love, and I'm good to him today. Now, this man who wrote this article, his name is Ruben Rosario, and he can be reached. And he actually encourages people, I think, to reach him by giving he has the, his address you can get him at, and he also has a telephone number, his email address and a telephone number. And I will reach him. That triggered me reading it, and it triggered me now as I was reading it. Because that so often we talk about the child within, Bill, and Doc, you know this, and MJ. That little kid inside never heals. Okay? And this is why child sexual abuse is so important. People out there, you have to understand that when a child has been abused, a part of them truly does not heal. Their childhood is taken away. It's just simply taken away. It's gone. And this little boy, he was blaming himself because he accepted the quarter. You see, he didn't tell anyone, and he accepted the quarter, and he would go and buy candy and little toys he could buy. This took place half a century ago, whatever, so he was able to buy quite a few things. You know, with the quarter, But the point is, when you're a child being abused, you are never to blame, and a big part of you doesn't heal. You don't just get over it. So I felt that it was a very good article.
Okay. Minnesota is, of course, one of the states that's considering lifting the statute of limitations. As we've talked about on other shows, that's the period of time that an abuse victim would have past their adult or past their childhood to go back and bring a case either in civil court or in criminal court against a perpetrator. In many cases, it's felt that since a lot of us some of us don't even remember, but many of us don't come to the conclusion that it's time to go public with our story. That's what that's part of what it's required. For 10 or 20 or 30 years, that the statute of limitation should be a long-running thing. And in some states, it has been a very few years. Now, a couple of states are considering in a couple of past a lifting of the statute of limitations so that either they're giving a long time, in one case 30 years, in other cases none at all, for a case to be brought against a perpetrator. That's what the testimony was about that he refers to at the end of the article.
But, you know, he also gives so much the human element to it, Bill, how a child feels and how he, he sort of like put it in a different part of his brain like I did, okay? A lot of us do that. And then all of a sudden I did decide to come forth, and I needed help, and I knew it. And I started to connect those dots with my own behaviors, you know, because I was suicidal. I had suicidal ideations and all this other stuff and all the drinking and everything. And part of the time I didn't want to live, another part of the time I did want to live, and then I had two children, I knew I had to live. And, you know, so this man is really painting a picture for people who don't really understand what sexual abuse does to a child. You know, and I liked the way he wrote that article, and I was very moved by it. And I will contact him. Let's see what happens.
He's joining a chorus of a growing group of people who have gone public with their stories, including mm-hmm. yourself, Carol, and myself, mm-hmm. who have gone public with their stories in a lot of detail and are willing to either write about it or talk about it in public. He's just come to the conclusion, apparently, in the last year or so, to write about it. And I think he has more to learn, frankly, but that's mm-hmm. okay. We have special shows that sometimes feature people who come on and tell their stories. And every one of those stories is similar to this, except it has its own facts in it, in many ways. The innocence of the youth that was taken advantage of by somebody older, who nonetheless felt a sense of guilt or remorse, hid the story, didn't have anybody that they could tell, or God forbid they told and they weren't believed, or nobody brought them help. And so in their adulthood, they tried to deal with it themselves, a lot of that being through denial and trying to cover up how they felt about themselves by a variety of ways. In his case, he mentions drinking and putting together making sure the rest of his life looked so good that nobody would question him.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But inside, the whole time, which is typical, the story eats away at you, mm-hmm. and eventually you're... hopefully, you brought to the conclusion that it's better to reveal your story in a situation where you can trust the person or persons that you're telling your story. Many times, that's with someone who themselves has experienced recovery, and sometimes not. But whoever it is, that giving away of your story for the first time, it becomes a gateway to get out of victimization and into survivorship and recovery. Mm-hmm. That period of time can last quite a while, and depending on who you do the work with, you probably end up repeating your story over and over and over, and in the process hear other people's stories and hopefully be given lots of suggestions about tools that you can use or techniques you can do or things you can try to lessen the impact of your child abuse story and increase the likelihood that you're going to have a more fulfilling life until eventually you do it long enough, you become what we refer to here often as a thriver. So you go from victim to survivor to thriver. And that's the path to recovery that we talk about. But he's joined Chorus, and he's a writer, so obviously he has a venue to do this in his columns and so forth,
right,
which is great. And hopefully he's reached a lot of people.
Well, I'm gonna call him. I have no problems doing that, and I'm going to speak to him directly and see if they'll allow for me to speak to him directly. I think they certainly will, because he can be contacted. So,
I'm sure he will.
Yeah. And I'm going to tell him all about us and ask him to come on the show.
Sure.
The ultimate goal for someone that's dealing with any kind of trauma, including child abuse, is learning to put the past behind you. Not to deny that it happened.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but to put to get to the point where what happened in the past is not having a positive, not having a significant impact on your present or your future.
Right.
Okay, that's the ultimate goal. Okay, and working to heal that child, heal that inner child. You know, so that you may have a minor trigger, but you're not gonna flip out or have a lot of the reactions that you had had throughout your life when certain things triggered you.
Right.
That's the ultimate goal. The ultimate goal is to try to get the past behind you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And
I agree. Mm-hmm. Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm.
There are a variety of different roads to recovery, journeys of healing, as Carol likes to say. But left to our own devices, unless we get on one of them, the likelihood is that we will continue to suffer, as he describes. It's just not something that we usually can find a place of comfort by ourselves. We really do need the help of a trained professional, a trusted group, sometimes a minister, a spouse, of course. But I think what's described here is a gateway into recovery rather than a recovery. And I just want to be honest about what I'm reading. I wasn't triggered by it. I certainly identified with all of it, but I wasn't triggered by it. So, we would like to have him, and we've had many people come on who are survivors themselves. And when they do that, we generally want to talk about the solution as much as we can. But at the beginning of the show, we do ask each of them to describe to us, you know, what their childhood was like. So we hear a lot of these stories on the air as at least the first part of many of the special guest shows, when the special guest is themselves a survivor. And we have quite a few of them. If you go back in the special guest archives and you want to actually hear someone talking about their experience, you can do that. You can find survivor stories. And we'd be happy to do more of them. There's really nothing we'd rather do and talk about someone who's gone from survivor to thriver, you know, someone who's really healing, accepting their past without it letting it run them anymore, and instead has a fulfilling kind of life now because of the work that they're doing. We also have had people who have called in and said, I've never talked about this before, but, and they've told us their story for the first time. And when that happens, there are a few shows like that in our special guest archives. It's a very special thing for us because it's a symbol, a sign that the person who's calling in understands that we are indeed a group of people that you can trust, where you will be safe, where you will take care of you, will serve you in any way we can, and try to steer you in the right direction as often as we can, and so forth. So we have some of those on our list of archive shows as well.
Oh, yeah.
I will say this, that silence almost guarantees that your suffering will continue.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
No, absolutely. Absolutely, Jay. See, what got me so was the very, very first sentence. The little boy, no more than 7, knew what was coming when the orange drapes were drawn in the bedroom window of the ground floor of the Bronx apartment on Holt Avenue. Well, I used to sit there in that bedroom, and I'd watch the doorknob turn. And when that doorknob turned, I knew that my abuser, my uncle, was going to come in and sexually abuse me. So he's watching the orange drapes, and I'm watching the doorknob. See, that's where it started to happen.
Yeah.
And yeah, very, very much so. So it was the very first sentence. And then, of course, there were other things throughout the article that I could so well, you know, say, well, that was me, you know, I could identify with. But, no, I would love to have him on the show. Let's see if I can get him on.
Okay, sounds good.
Yeah.
Sounds good.
Yeah.
And I guess I should say at this point that we are looking for someone that can help us with procuring special guests. We had a guest coordinator for a long time that did a terrific job, and then he got a job, he got work, mm-hmm. and he became too busy to assist us in this way. But we have quite a cadre of already existing special guests who would love to come back. That almost every one of them says, you could have me back, and we promise that we'll get back to them. Plus new people like this gentleman and many others who we've not yet had on. And that in itself is a job, just kind of reach out to some of these people and schedule them for a night they can appear Monday to Friday. You don't have to do the convincing part. If you get a nibble, Carol or myself can take over from there, at least at the beginning. Mm-hmm. And certainly we will help anyone who's interested. But this is an excellent opportunity for people. They say they want to volunteer with us. We have a need here. You do it from your home. You do it by phone and email, basically. And you do it under Carol's supervision at first until you're comfortable, and we'll help you.
Yeah.
So that's a terrific job opportunity for someone. We would refer to you as the guest coordinator eventually. It's the equivalent of an associate producer's role on a show, on a radio show, regular radio show. And, and you'd be being of service to a big community of people throughout North America and beyond. All right. This is the Community Participation Show, and you can call in directly at 646-595-2118 to join us. 646-595-2118. To remind you, the topics tonight are already all selected. You just pick out the one you want to talk about, along with the panel. But they're available on the front page of either of our two websites at lacp.org or NASCA, NAASCA.org. You'll find a picture of a microphone. Next to that, in red letters, it says tonight, which means that tonight's show is about. It says Community Matters, a discussion of the news of the week from lacp.org. Click that once. And NASCA.org, click that once. And two separate pages will open in different tabs. And those are the articles that have appeared all week long that we will use tonight as possible topics of conversation. We'll tell you which page we're going off of, how far down the page the article appears, and then the headline of the article before we start talking, so everybody has a chance to find the material ahead of time. You should be on week 4 of February, the final week of February, and you should be February 25th should be the date at the top of the LACP page. Again, 646-595-2118. Still have plenty of time in tonight's show, so who has another article they'd like to go with?
I do, if we want to.
Okay.
Near the bottom of the page, maybe 2/3 of the way down out of Pennsylvania.
You need to move your microphone a little closer to your mouth, okay? Please.
Yeah, that's as close as I can get it. Still.
Wow.
Still a little fuzzy?
Can't hear
it's
you,
distant.
Honey.
It's distant.
Yeah.
It's not fuzzy. It's a matter of volume.
Haven't changed a thing. Let me call you back.
All right. While MJ redials, and I'll bring her right back on when she comes. Do either of you guys have anything? I'll tell you about something that I learned that's probably of interest to people that are listening, and that is that we had an email from the 1 in 6 organization, which has told me that they are now instituting a Canadian version of the 1 in 6 program, which has to do with male survivor groups and survivor issues. It's been 1in6.org is the website for them. And they've been in the United States for a number of years. They're now branching out to include Canada, and there will be a series of events that will announce this through March and I think into April in Ottawa and Toronto and maybe a couple other cities as well. I've actually asked the new director for 1in6 if he would like to come on the show to talk about it, so maybe we'll have him as a special guest. He hasn't gotten back to me yet. Now MJ is back with us, and we will go to an article, which is how far down the page, please, MJ?
Can you hear me better now?
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
Okay. All right. About 3/4 of the way down out of Pennsylvania, proposed Pennsylvania bill would prevent rape victims from choosing between the rapist, parental rights, and child support. Mm. Now, this is a law I've known about for quite some time. Truly needs changing. If a woman is raped and bears a child as a result of that crime, she can get child support from the rapist only if she agrees to giving him some parental rights, visitation, so on and so forth. And how wrong is that?
It's kind of that's like being held hostage.
Exactly. And Pennsylvania is not the only state that has that law in effect, but they're right now discussing the fact that, you know, they would like to change that law. Let the woman terminate those parental rights and still collect the child support, you know, which she probably needs. But if you read down through this article, there are some other states that some of these laws, you just wonder, what were people thinking of, you know, when they created these laws?
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, this is... I think something that's much needed. Here again, wouldn't it be great if you could get a national bill passed, say this is the way it's going to be?
Yeah.
Because you're traumatizing these women again, and, you know, and as the article brings out, many times, you know, the chances are that the rapist is not going to want to see that child anyway. But how many are truly sadistic enough that, hey, if I'm going to pay for this, I'm going to see that kid whether I want to or not. And to put the woman through that each and every single time that man makes an appearance in their life, that's horrible.
You know, one of the statements you made is, what were they thinking?
Yeah.
Okay, well, if you look at some of the attitudes about rape that have been espoused over the past couple of years, that's exactly what they were thinking, and it's about misinformation and a lot of beliefs that aren't true, and the superiority of men over women. I mean, that's what it goes back to. You know, women as second class citizens.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's where all these laws come from. It's an old concept of a double standard. You know, there's a certain standard for men and a certain standard for women. And that's where all of this stuff comes from. So that's what they were thinking.
Yeah. There's a statistic here. It says nationwide about 32,100 women become pregnant from rape each year. Now, this goes back to numbers from 1996. But it says Pennsylvania lawmakers have made unsuccessful efforts in the past to ban custody or visitation for rapist fathers altogether, unless the child is of suitable age and consents to the father's rights. Now you're bringing the child in who is the product of that rape,
right,
of that crime. You know, maybe the mother has decided, I don't want the child to be further traumatized by knowing they're a product of rape. But here this law says if the child consents to it, then that's not, oh, how screwed up.
Yeah, that's a mess.
Exactly.
Really.
You know, I got to think about this. I'm not sure how I stand on some of this because I am an adopted infant. And I was adopted when I was just a few months old, but I've never known the situation I was adopted out of, and I've never known who my father was, much less, well, I've never known who my mother was. You know, I did learn her name by accident once, but I never looked any further. I do know her name. For me, it has never been a big enough issue for me to go hunting for my real mother, quote unquote, much less my real father. But I know that because I am familiar with other adoptive kids, that it is an issue for them, and that they want to know. They want to know. I'm uncomfortable putting them all in one basket and saying they shouldn't ever know. There needs to be some thought given to the possibility. Maybe it's not until they're 18, mm-hmm. but somehow of relocating their parents. Of course, there are lots of groups. I don't belong to any of them that for adopted kids, adoptive people, who are searching for parents or deal with these parents and children's rights and adoptive kids' rights and so forth. And a lot of them are, frankly, looking for comfortable ways to seek birth parents and information on their birth parents. So I'm not clear on all of the issues that are in this article where I stand, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
Well, honestly, I truly believe, you know, once an adopted child becomes an adult, if they choose to know their family history and background, that's their right. I truly believe that.
Yeah.
And they shouldn't be kept from that, you know. If for no other reason, just for their health history, what was their family, you know, what problems did their family have, you know, what's in their genes? You have a right to know that. So I have no issue at all with...
I've never been able to answer any of those questions, of course. When they ask about family histories, and this has happened many, many times, I always say, I don't know, I'm adopted. Then they ask me the next question, and I say, I don't know, I'm adopted. Then they ask me the next question, and finally, I had a testicular cancer, and I was due to have surgery the next day, and I couldn't answer these questions, and the nurse that was taking the history was more and more frustrated. She finally got to a question which read, have you ever had surgery where you've been under anesthetic? And I said, anesthesia. And I said, well, I had my tonsils out when I was 6, and boy, did she light up. Finally, I had something I could answer. The rest of it was a complete blank, and that's how it normally is. You know, I don't know my biological past. But, you know, there are rights to all these parties that we're talking about, and I've heard of some organizations that will take the name of one party, and if it matches the name of another party and both parties are searching, then they'll put you together. And that's, I don't know, something about that feels right to me. I don't know that what the circumstances of why a woman would give up a child, they must have been very serious. Most women wouldn't automatically give up their child, and it might be because she was raped, or it might be because she couldn't afford it, or, you know, I don't know. It could, might be anything.
Mm-hmm.
And I just say I inadvertently discovered my birth mother's name at the time of my birth, but I've never known who the father was, you know. And I even accidentally found out my birth mother's name. I wasn't really hunting for it. So, I don't know. I have mixed feelings.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that if you had any real curiosity or you wanted, you know, information, I think you would have done something by now, you know.
I know, but my mixed feelings are, but I don't speak for every adoptive kid. I wouldn't assume that.
Yeah.
I know lots of adoptive kids who have, as they say, gone off and looked for their parents.
Oh, yeah.
My sister did. Mm-hmm. We were brought up in the same environment, she and I, but
mm-hmm.
she did. I mean, I don't know how far she got. We never talked about it, she and I, searching for our real parents. We talked about how we felt about the parents we had when we
right.
were little. But I know right. at one point she ran away from home for a couple of weeks when she was in her teens. She actually ran to my cousin's house, my older cousin's house, a cousin who was out of her family and living in New York. And I don't know what they did together to try and find my sister's parents, but that was what that was about. I know that that was what that running away was about.
Mm-hmm.
But I wouldn't presume to speak for all kids who have been adopted, all people who have been adopted. I don't know. I just know there are different issues.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because I feel one way doesn't mean everybody does, nor does it mean I'm right for everybody.
No.
Well, like you said, I don't think one person or one institution can speak for all adopted kids because every circumstance is different. You can't lump everybody into the same category.
That's what I'm saying. I think
no.
a lot of careful thought needs to go into this, and perhaps providing a path where from each direction, if the gate at the other end of the path was open, you know, you could meet each other. You know, find out who each other's are, get the history. But if one side or the other was closed, you know, there's a reason for it. You know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I think everyone has a right to, if they have that in stardom where they really want to know, they have a hole inside. Some kids, you know, it affects people differently. Some kids think, okay, I had an adopted friend, okay? That's someone that took off to Newark that you were laughing about that time. She was adopted. She never had any desire to find out who her parents were. The people that adopted her were her parents as far. That's how she felt, and that's how she was.
Right, me too. Yeah,
yeah. But there
but
might
that's
be...
That's not a uniform. That's not a uniform way of thinking, though, Carol.
No.
Right?
Okay. No. What I'm saying is, you know, everyone's different. That's why I said that. You know, so there's some people who do want to know, and then there's those that don't. You know, it's as simple as
I
that.
I mean, maybe there could be some kind of blind way for you to learn what MJ is suggesting is important, and it is in some cases, of course,
mm-hmm.
the medical history of your family,
mm-hmm.
of your genetic family. Maybe some blind way to know if that was your purpose, you know, without the revelation of who the person's the mother and father were. I don't know. This would I'd have to give some thought to what I'd be comfortable with as a standard way that this would happen. I'd be happy to see something come about because I know there are a lot of people that bemoan this situation and suffer behind it.
The best thing is to have a separate organization whereby anybody, parent or child, searching, you know, can get into this organization and be reconnected.
Mm-hmm.
Because
you know, the sad thing is, when I was adopted, of course, it was nearly 60 years ago, okay? And at that time, it was in New York City. My parents had tried to have their own children unsuccessfully and were told that it was endangering my mother's life to try again. So she had a final pregnancy, which resulted in a premature birth, and she was very ill from it, and the baby died 3 days later.
Mm-hmm.
They said at that point, you need to consider adoption. You should not risk another pregnancy. And then, so they went I think, Catholic Charities. And in any case, there was a rule in New York City, the point I'm trying to make, there was a rule that you could only have two kids. And they were very careful about selecting kids that were similar in, say, looks, at least, to the parents. So I was Caucasian. My parents were Caucasian. I was blue-eyed. They were blue-eyed. You know, I was a blonde-looking kid. So, you know, I mean, I fit them not only genetically and probably was born in a Catholic family, I'm guessing. That's a guess. But they, in other words, they went way out of their way to match the child with an quote, appropriate parent, and you could only have two. Nowadays, if you come forward and you're willing to be a foster parent or an adoptive parent, and you have even limited wherewithal, but enough love, they feel like you have enough care and love in your family, there are so many kids available. And they mix and match families, and I have cousins who have mixed and matched families now, with, you know, some of their own, some from Asia, some from Africa, some from, you know, locally. They're so desperate because the number of kids available nowadays is tremendous compared to the number of kids, you know, back then.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And the women that are having kids that are giving them up, it's an alarming number. A lot of single mothers, of course, rapes too, obviously. Mm-hmm. But a lot of just teen pregnancies and so forth, where they give up the babies. And these babies, if they're not adopted, become, you know, wards of the state. And they shuffle them around from foster care to foster care home. I have a bunch of friends who were in that situation, which thank God I wasn't. As an adopted kid, I could have gone down that path, but our family was a good match. I was adopted at a few months old, and a year and a half later, my sister, who is not my, you know, blood sibling, but was definitely my sister, was brought in, and she was an infant. And that was it. That was the cap. Two kids.
Mm-hmm.
Per couple.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So there's an awful lot of issues that surround this that don't, you know, that need to be worked on.
Yeah.
We know statistically, just as an aside, but coming back to the theme of the general theme of our organization, that children who end up in foster care are abused and traumatized at an amazing rate, significantly higher than kids in other categories.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the couple of categories that really stand out, another being indigenous children born to American Indian families. That's a very high rate of abuse. And then kids that are born into very inner city situations where there's a lot of social issues, you know, a lot of single mothers, a lot of unemployment, a lot of disease, a lot of drug use, a lot of gang activity, crime, high crime, those kids too.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of stress in the inner cities.
Oh, yeah. God, yes.
But it is a problem that exists throughout the country, every community. And I'm talking about small towns, and I'm talking about suburbia, and I'm talking about, you know, uptown and downtown. It doesn't matter where the child is from. They are susceptible and at risk to the tune of 1 in 4 girls and 1 in 6 boys who will be sexually assaulted before their 18th birthday. Another whole group of them that will be violently or physically abused. Another whole set that will be emotionally traumatized. And a final set it'll be neglected through maltreatment or whatever. So that when you add these numbers up, we now have 42 million American adults just of the first category alone, of the sexual assault category. And at least a similar or even bigger number when you add those other three kinds of childhood traumas of adults who have suffered from one of those other three as well. So this is not a small problem. This is not even an epidemic. It's a pandemic. It's a problem of such proportions that it's out of control, and we don't have an answer for it, and we don't have a will to get an answer for it. Not a national will. We have individual wills, but not, we don't, as a whole, as our society is structured, have a desire to make this a priority And so year after year after year, 1 in 4 girls and 1 in 6 boys are the group who will, not that it's not the at-risk group, that's the group that will be sexually abused before they're 18. 1 in 4 girls and 1 in 6 boys. It's 20%, because that averages out, is 1 in 5 of reported cases. 20% of our children.
Mm-hmm. When I tell people that, Bill, when I go out, and they just look at me bug-eyed. You know, they don't know the statistics. And just that one alone in itself, you know, before I come out with the 850,000 who were sexually abused and then go into all the others. And then finally at the end, always leaving a lasting impression about the $124 billion, and then it's $585 billion over the course of the lifetime and how it affects it, and then breaking that down. People are just blown away. They really are. They don't understand, you know. And that's why it's so important for us to get out there and make people aware of why this is such a major issue.
Right.
You know, absolutely.
You know what I'm beginning to believe?
What's that?
That one of the reasons that there's so much reticence to mm-hmm. address the issue mm-hmm. is mm-hmm. I think as a society there's a collective amount of shame on so many levels about this,
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
and I think that's what keeps people from really really looking at the issue and embracing the issue and getting involved in changing things. Because it's just, you know, the level of shame for in our society.
Well, I agree. It's a mixture of that and denial and a taboo of wanting to even talk about it. It's all those added together.
Right, but the taboo mm-hmm. is involves shame about sex and, you know.
Yeah.
So it's a deep-seated shame about the entire issue. I don't want to talk about that.
Right.
Yeah, but, you know, I believe that some of that shame is coming because there's so much of it in the families, okay? And I have friends who, just like myself, had been sexually abused by people in their own family, and they don't want society to know about it. Now, I'll talk about anything now. But at one time, I wouldn't, refer to my sibling as a person who also was sexually abusing me, because it is such a taboo thing to think that someone would do that and you didn't get the help that you needed. I mean, who wants to hear about that? Holy Christopher, you know what I'm saying? But today, more people are opening up and talking about it. There is an article in here. I don't know where it is because I'm on another one. But well, even in the first article that I had read, he felt, this the journalist had felt too, that there's more enlightenment with people, you know, not just about sexual abuse, but, you know, that it happens in the families and so forth. And I do believe that there is more people, and there are more people, rather, that are willing to listen. Because I'm out there all the time, and there's only been a couple of people that didn't really want to hear what I had to say. So...
Let's use the journalism as an example. Excuse me, Jen,
yeah.
Just one thought.
Sure.
The journalism admitted in the end of his article that 20 years ago he'd written about a case that had very much impressed him about a woman that came forward and insisted that mm-hmm. her name be included in the article he wrote. In other words, he was knowledgeable and impressed by this, yet he kept his own story for another 20 years.
Yeah.
And the shame in his story was that it happened in his family. That
right.
happened at the hands of a cousin,
right?
And that he hadn't told his mother and so forth. That is denial and shame. This man professionally knew, you know, how important it was for this girl to come forward, and was very and wrote about it, and admits in today's article about how impressed he was about it. Yet couldn't bring himself to even admit it to a therapist or to. It's a single person, much less go public until now. You know, and he told his wife eventually.
it is such a shameful and personal thing that happens to you when you're being abused by an uncle, like in my case, or by his cousin or whomever in the family, a brother, okay? I mean, I've had uncle and brother, and then some guy kidnaps me. I mean, this is ridiculous. I mean, come on. You know, it's I'd rather talk about the guy who kidnapped and raped me than, this is going back 10 years ago, say, than my brother, which is something that I'm just bringing to the forefront recently.
I
said, come on the show.
Understand that.
Yeah. Okay. And I spoke about my uncle. I had no problem with that. But it's just so deep.
I interrupted Jay. I want to give him a chance, but I have another thought. Go ahead, Jay.
All I was going to say was listening is one thing. Getting involved and, doing stuff about it is another thing. You know, listening is probably a lot easier. It's a lot easier to listen than to get involved to get behind an issue.
Right.
That's why I usually include denial as part of the problem. It's impossible that we don't know children who are being abused. It's just that we don't want to know, and we choose to turn away. And we don't want to look at it. But with the number of children who are abused all around us in every part of society, it's impossible statistically that we don't know who they are, and it's impossible statistically that we don't know fellow adult survivors, or that normal people don't know adult survivors, or adult survivors don't know each other,
mm-hmm.
because there's this denial of the need to talk about it, the misunderstandings are huge about our own self-guilt about going back to it. You know, my story would have started with Carol with, maybe it would start with the sense of what was about to happen as I was led across the courtyard to the dark room where once again I knew he'd shut the door and put the light on. I've talked about this many times.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, my abuser, for those of you who don't know, original abuser was a camp counselor, and I was very young and completely away from home. I didn't have a family to turn to. And besides, he was a Catholic brother. And the guilt is about my going along with him, knowing what was going to happen. It had happened so many times before.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not the first time that it happened you get that guilt. It's the next time and the time after that and the time after that. And
that's
it lives with you forever. That's right. The sense of, my going back into that dark room because it felt good, what he did to me. And I'm ashamed, but that, of my childish attraction to a sexual experience. To it
and the attention.
Well, and the attention, whatever.
A lot of kids feel special because they're getting one-on-one attention from an adult.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I'm being simplistic. But for the sake of just getting through the show, I just want you to know. I mean, you said the first line was the line that got you. We all mm-hmm. have a first line like that.
Right, right.
You know, and it's a writer's job to write the first line that'll get you to get to the third paragraph and so on,
He did a good job.
Oh, yeah, he did. It was very well written first line.
I mean, look what I'm doing. I'm going to call him.
Sure, sure.
Hey,
It's often the filmmaker's job to hook you in the first 3 minutes,
He got me the first 3 seconds.
but different meaning. You know what I'm saying?
I know what you're saying.
That's what it's all about.
Mm-hmm.
So we all, but the point is we all have something like that that is a part of our story, that's attached to, people describe it in different ways, guilt, shame, responsible, feeling self-responsible and so forth. A lot of us feel that way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Or just that we couldn't help it. You know, what could we do?
You're just
so we
a
went
little
along.
Kid. You were a little
so
kid.
So we went along. Yeah. We had nobody to turn to. I didn't know where my parents were. They were hundreds of miles away, and I knew no one else. What could I do? So there's lots of different ways to see these stories, but it is important that they're talked about openly. That's the important thing.
Oh yeah.
No, you know, and that over time, we can break through that taboo and that shame of hearing somebody say, "I was a damaged kid, but I'm working on myself now."
Mm-hmm.
That's what we want to hear.
Right.
You know.
You're on the healing journey. That's what I say.
Yeah.
Healing journey. Right.
Yeah. Did you say you had another article, somebody, or you
I
to move on? Go ahead.
Yeah.
Tell us where.
This is a good one. This is it's about the Blue Ribbons. This is Oklahoma Challenge. It's on the NASCA site, and it's still a little more than a quarter way down. Oklahoma.
Okay. About Oklahoma. What's
mm-hmm.
the title of the article?
It says Challenge. Julian wants to see Blue Forest of Treats for Child Abuse Awareness.
Okay.
Yeah. Maybe I'll do that around here. See what happens. It'd be interesting. Okay, it says here, Jody Julian. Did you find it?
Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Jody Julian is extending a challenge to community entities throughout the county to build a blue ribbon tree for Child Abuse Prevention Month in April. Julian Department of Human Services resource specialist for Garfield and Grant counties hopes to see trees with blue ribbons all over that county and everywhere, actually, is what he'd like to see, okay? Now, last year, DHS made a blue ribbon tree in a mall in an old store window. This is what people can do, okay? This year, I want to do something a little bit different. She hopes to see a blue forest of trees for child abuse prevention awareness. Now, that would be quite a job. Wouldn't it be cool to see blue ribbons all over the community? Schools, libraries, churches, civic and community groups, child care centers, child care centers, hospitals, medical facilities could lead the way in creating awareness of child abuse prevention. DHS officials confirmed 93 incidents of child abuse or neglect in Garfield County during 2012. And 130 children in DHS custody in the county, Julian said. That's just one county alone. The Child Abuse Prevention Action Committee recommends blue ribbon trees to be displayed before April begins or at any time during the month of April. I think that's kind of cool. I might do one and see what happens. It says here, trees can be registered in the official tree registry by sending in a registration form and no more than two photos. Tree photos received by April 3rd will be featured during CAP Day at the Capitol on April 9th and so forth. To make a blue ribbon tree, select a living tree or construct a tree from any material, then decorate it with blue ribbons. Ribbons on trees can represent the number of new babies born in the community, the confirmed number of abused and neglected children in a county, or something significant to the designers of the tree. And then they say that at the bottom there that says they've seen people, even if they just tie a ribbon. You know how you see the yellow ribbons around the trees? Even if they just tie ribbons of a blue ribbon around trees, something.
Right. Okay. Now, we should explain that the color blue is to child abuse
mm-hmm.
what the color pink is to breast cancer.
That's right.
Everybody sees breast cancer as we see pink all over the place. As the awareness color and the ribbon that's worn for that, yellow for returning troops and support of veterans and so forth, yellow
mm-hmm.
ribbons. Well, blue is the color for child abuse. And it's not just ribbons, of course. There have been organizations that have done pinwheels, we heard about, balloons,
mm-hmm.
we've heard about, quilts have been done, and, of course, all kinds of clothing, T-shirts, and so forth that are blue with a logo or something like that. The blue color is the important thing, but the ribbon is important because it can be so easily created and worn. There was a time when we didn't have blue ribbons, so we went out and we bought a spool of blue ribbon and made them up ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And we cut them. Just all you need to do is cut a piece of blue ribbon off of a spool, right? Make it 8 or 10 inches long, fold it in half with a safety pin or a straight pin, and you got a blue ribbon you can wear on your lapel. And we did that.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can take a tree, and it could be contingent on the number of branches that are off the tree, how many blue ribbons, whatever looks good. It doesn't have to be a specific number. But I like the idea. of having the kids interact by having them perhaps get a bush like a tree that's a dead tree, a bush, that kind of thing, and let them tie blue ribbons on the ends of the branches, something like that. It would be an interactive project that you could use to get kids to talk about the topic, and you could, use it as a tool. The point is that the blue ribbon, we want to raise the consciousness. We have our own blue ribbon campaign, and we're certainly going to be offering them for free to anyone who writes to us and asks for them. We may offer an opportunity to send us maybe a $2 donation to cover the stamp and the envelope, so forth. And maybe we'll send three or four if somebody does that. But the point is that we want to promote the concept of the blue ribbon being worn, especially since April, which is coming up, it's less than a month away, is Child Abuse Awareness Month.
That's right.
Child Abuse Awareness Month is a once-a-year event that we're now celebrating nationally as the 30th year, 30th anniversary of Child Abuse Awareness Month. It started in Ronald Reagan's time of office by a proclamation that he put forward, and it's been celebrated ever since. This marks its 30th year, and there will be lots of activities and events throughout the month, but especially on one particular day, which has been set aside by a number of groups, many of them coordinated through what's called the Innocence Revolution, for April 14th, right in the middle of the month, as an awareness day. But the whole month is Awareness Month. If you're interested in, we promote this concept from all the groups, and you want to know more about it, you can get in touch with us or go to theinnocencerevolution.net. That's their website, theinnocencerevolution.net, and read more about it. But there are about half the states in the country represented at this point with some kind of an event in each of those states that's devoted to the April 14th date. But it doesn't matter what date you pick. It matters that you pick something. And it really matters what you do on April 15th and on May 1st. That's what really matters.
Yeah. You know, I go so along with that, Bill. I mean, I'm getting all these emails now, about April 14th, and it's a wonderful thing. I think everyone is like an outcry all over the country and other countries, too. Not just the United States, other countries, but you're so right. Because April 15th, it's like Christmas is one day, the spirit of Christmas should be all year round, okay? And what we're doing should be all year round. Not just on December 25th for Christmas or April 14th, for child abuse awareness. This is something that is a 365-day a year affair, okay? So, but I would love to see the schools in particular get involved, have the kids. He came up with a good idea there. Pick a tree outside and have the cooperation of the schools, go out there and let the kids put that on those trees, a tree, one tree, a bush, like you said, whatever.
Right, right.
Let them
decorate,
do that.
Have the kids decorate it, right.
Yeah, and then that way they're taking part in, and also it's being explained to them why, and it's bringing forth, again, a recognition, and that's being proactive. Look, people out there, we're putting blue ribbons here because, okay, this is Child Abuse Awareness Month because there's so much child abuse out there. It's an epidemic.
Well, that's a great project right there. I don't know if we're too late to come up with it, but every school in the country ought to do a child abuse awareness tree with ribbons on the end of the limbs.
I like that.
That'd be great. Yeah. The ribbons are available off of our website right now, but I'm going to change that maybe as soon as tomorrow. I just looked up how to do it, how to provide a way to order them. And before the show started, I was actually on the phone with PayPal for an hour and 45 minutes waiting for them to answer, and they didn't.
No.
So I'll call him tomorrow to get the updated information that I need. But I will be able to create some method of communicating with us your desire for Blue Ribbons, and we'll put a new link on our website. We'll also send you a business card with pertinent information, a hotline number, some of the statistics of child abuse, our website link, web address, and a packet of information that maybe I can format into a trifold or something small so it doesn't cost much in the mail to send, but inclusive of topics and, again, statistics and reasons that this is important and discussion points. We hope that people will become very familiar with this and be willing to take this to groups that they meet with wherever public safety is of an issue. We feel that the Blue Ribbons should be shared.
Mm-hmm,
and, of course, we'll continue the concept of selling Blue Ribbons at our cost or providing them at our cost to anyone who wants 50 at a time or 100 at a time. So they can go out in the community if they belong to a neighborhood watch or a community improvement association or, any group, a church group, Boys and Girls Club, where public safety is one of the things that they are concerned with and talk about, and take the time to hold a meeting where you pass out the Blue Ribbon and the associated card and talk about the issue for 20 minutes, half an hour, 45 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
I think we need to bring up, though, if anybody listening thinks it's a great idea to go to their school and say, hey, let's decorate a tree or a shrub, the ribbons we provide wouldn't be appropriate for that. These are lapel ribbons.
No, I know.
So
our ribbons, our version, are meant to be worn on your... No.
Yeah.
Our ribbons are... No, but I'm saying that it's as simple as going to, a craft store, basically.
Sure.
Wherever you can buy blue-colored ribbon in a one-inch strip or one-and-a-half-inch strip and buy a couple of rolls of them. It's cheap. And cut them in 10-inch strips or 12-inch strips, whatever it turns out is appropriate for the size tree you're wearing or the size lapel you have, and pass them out.
I just think they could get that size ribbon from us.
No, I'm sorry. That's right. Good point. Ours are for people to wear. So that the question will arise, frankly, what's the blue ribbon for? And that's your chance to say, I'm wearing it in recognition of the need for the community to talk about child abuse issues, and you get into the conversation that way. So, and keep the business card in your pocket so you'll have a couple of things you can talk about, or in your wallet or your purse.
Mm-hmm.
They say, I don't think it's that big of a problem, and you can look at it and see 42 million American adults have already suffered from childhood sexual assault trauma, in our country today. And that's just our country.
Mm-hmm. That's right. So. That's exactly right. I mean, I have the old ones that say 39, but I also have my daughter who's sick now also. I don't know what's going on with my family. They're all falling apart. But she's designing one that has 42, and then I'm going to have thousands of cards made up, Bill. So that
The next version of our printed card will say 42.
Those were
made a couple years ago, so they reflect, a million and a half more kids have become adults, 850,000 a year, who experience childhood sexual trauma, and, they all, that number become adults each year.
Right.
They're replaced on the back end by a new fresh crop of two-year-olds and four-year-olds. And we hear about two-year-olds and four-year-olds all the time who are sexually assaulted. It's a shame. But a significant percentage of the children who are raped are 8 years old and younger. It's a shocking figure, 20-something percent. And, of course, they have absolutely no recourse if they're taken by an adult, and the intention is the adult to be a predator and use them sexually, the child has no options. They're too weak, too innocent, too unknowledgeable, and just too small to defend himself.
Yeah. And that's why I go to the daycare centers a lot. But I'm going to start doing the other schools, too. I have some speaking engagements coming up. So, you know, I went over to high school, and then there's middle school I'm getting in contact with. And of course, April 16 is coming up. That's going to be a biggie. But I like that idea with the schools and the ribbons. I wish I'd seen that sooner and thought about it sooner. You know, I know that there's some schools that do, in this area, that do celebrate the, you know, the blue ribbon, but they do it in their way. I have to find out more exactly what they're into, you know, how they do it and what they do. But definitely by next year, Bill, I'm going to have ribbons everywhere. Watch me.
Well, you know, the point that we like to make is awareness isn't enough. Obviously, awareness needs to happen.
Yeah.
But it's not good. It's not good enough to be aware unless you're willing to do something. It has to be followed up by action. You know, by each of us acting in our own way and whatever degree we can be engaged in doing what we can to defeat, you know, the predators that are out there, to reduce the incidents that are currently going on. And, of course, because we are NASCA, Adult Survivors of Child Abuse, we hope there's a more compassion, understanding, and of the need and support for adult survivors who need to come forward. And one of the things they need to do, they need to talk about it. Let them talk about it. You know, encourage them to talk about it. Encourage support groups for them. But whatever you can do, though, the point is that it's not enough to just be aware. Every adult, I think, has a responsibility for every child, certainly, but also to each other to do what we can. Some of us are better at one thing than another. We have certain talents, or we have certain amount of money we can donate to causes, certain time we can donate to the issue. And so forth, but everybody has something that they can do. Mm-hmm. And it's going to take all those things combined to anytime soon put a dent in assisted child abuse.
That's right. That's right.
If you look on the NASCA site, about a third of the way from the top from New Hampshire, it gives a breakdown of the 2012 statistics for the state of New Hampshire.
Mm-hmm.
And it said 36% of the victims were male, 64 were female. Victim age, 30% were under 6, 40% were 7 to 12, and 30% were 12 to 18.
Mm-hmm.
I saw that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Those are pretty current statistics from last year.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Very good.
And I think that they're reflective of what's going on nationally.
Mm-hmm. Which is to say, you know, you can be anything from birth. We've seen children as young as a few months old reported to have been sexually assaulted. 3 months old, I think, was the youngest we ever saw. I don't know, maybe it was two. But it was 2 or 3 months old. And we see them at every age, is the point. There's no age at which a child is safe. Children who are not informed are not safe all the way through their childhood.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and once they become an adult at age 18, they go away from or 19, I guess, they leave the statistics, but they're still damaged susceptible if they were victimized. You tend more to be likely to be additionally victimized, even in your adulthood.
Mm-hmm.
And this number, you know, it grows every year. That's why it used to be 39 million. Now it's 42 million that they're using.
Mm-hmm.
That's the national. That's the official national number that they're using now. It's not our number. And of course, they say that they're not sure that these numbers are, you know, anything but conservative, because child abuse is one of the worst reported crimes, the least reported crimes there is. With 9 out of 10 adult children reporting that they did not get help in their youth, adult children of child abuse. It means only 1 in 10 are really reported in their youth. And that's an astonishing consideration when you think about, when they talk about how badly reported child abuse is and how few, how many cases they know, if it's 1 out of 10 that are really reported, or 3 out of 10, some small percentage like that, that means there's a lot of people out there who need help, desperately need help.
Yeah. And there's a lot of ashamed people out there, too, like Jay was saying before, and that's so often been the problem. You know, they're just plain too ashamed to talk about it, you know.
They think there's something wrong with them.
Sure. They look at themselves instead of the person that actually abused them. Why did this person come after me? There must be something wrong with me. You know, things like that.
And they feel like they're unique in that they're the only one, or
yeah,
almost the only one. And the truth is that, you know, a huge percentage of us have been traumatized. Huge,
yeah,
percentage. We just don't know each other until we're willing to talk about it. And then we start to realize that people we've known for years, you know, have had this issue for years. We just haven't known that they've had the issue for years.
Well, somehow, you know, I think we're going to do it. I really do. See, I'm always the one that's the optimistic one. And I believe in my heart that because so many people are starting to get involved now with different organizations and so forth, and things that they're doing, like this kid, he wants to do the tree. I mean, and then we have the Innocent Revolution coming up and all this other stuff. And I'm being asked to speak in colleges and everything I never thought would happen. People are talking more now, and I want to get out there that it's, like you said, yeah, we already know that there's public awareness, but we have to have people becoming proactive. We just simply do. And that's why that card says 1-800-4-A-CHILD, and I say it almost every night. You know, people out there, if you suspect abuse of a child, and if you're not sure, don't go and try to be detective, all right? Don't do that. You can get yourself in trouble that way. Just simply, you know, call that number, 1-800-4-A-CHILD, and they'll send people out in your area, and they'll make that determination as to whether there's something very bad happening to a child in that household. And you can be a hero to that child, because if there is something going on, you may have saved that child. And that's a good feeling.
All right, we still have 12 minutes left, so time for another story, or maybe even two if we wanted. Anybody got another one?
Well, there's one right below the one Jay just mentioned out of New Hampshire where he quoted the statistics. This kind of caught my attention, too. Out of Maryland, Maryland legislatures want to restrict custody rights for parents convicted of child sexual abuse. This kind of puts a little been on things too, you know. What rights do the parents have if they are convicted of mm-hmm. molesting or abusing somebody else's child? What's the danger that they pose to their own children?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
They have cases.
So they can.
Yeah. They cite cases where the parent was, you know, allowed to be around their own children, and then they were subsequently abused or so on. So what you think about that?
So this is to deny an adult who's convicted of an assault of a non-family member child, right,
mm-hmm.
from having custodial rights for their own children.
Or to make them supervised visits. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, it makes a lot of sense to me, I suppose. I know that a lot of abusers will tell you that they wouldn't think of abusing their own kids.
Yeah, well.
You know. But, yeah, makes sense to me.
I'd be reluctant to make it a blanket type of situation.
Yeah.
I think you have to have the latitude to be able to do that, but I don't think it should be arbitrary in every case, because every case is different. So I think that the authorities should have have the latitude to do that, okay, but not make it required.
It could be, for example, a possible increase in the limitations if you broke, you know, if you were a convicted sex offender and you were in that category already and you became suspicious that you were molesting your own children, that it could be added to what you were already experiencing. I agree with you, Jay. I don't like these things that paint a broad brush over every situation, and there has to be, conditions and exceptions allowed for almost everything we talk about, frankly.
Yeah.
Really?
I mean, that's how you end up with people on death row who are innocent.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Mm-hmm.
I think you need to have a certain level of trust of the people that you put in positions to make these decisions, okay, that they're not going to get it right every time, okay, but you need to take into consideration all the factors.
Well, I think giving them the authority to have that as one of the tools, though, is
absolutely
a good idea. Yeah.
Right, have that latitude to be able to do that.
Mm-hmm.
I agree.
Well, and I want to make the point that there's a lot we agree on. There's also things we don't agree on, and that's all okay. We as a group are a grassroots organization, and we feel that it would be remiss to allow a free discussion of these topics when they come up, and to allow for the fact that, you know, in certain cases we can come to basic agreement on an overall of the situations, which is horrible as it is, but then also there will be people who disagree, and that's okay. We can agree to disagree, but what we all do agree about is the horror of what's going on. We need to do something about it. There are just too many children we're sacrificing at too quick of a rate to believe that our sense of, you know, of national pride in the being the greatest nation on earth can continue, really, at this rate. We have to suffer as a society in a lot of different ways because of the number of children who are traumatized and the number of adults whose trauma story is never revealed, never talked about, never dealt with, the numbers who are never given an opportunity to recover. So that we can agree on, for sure.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. I have trouble with people who are abusers, who sexually abuse children with their own children, because I personally know, but that's only one case, okay, where the abuser then abused his own child. So I don't know. I don't know how I feel about that one.
Well, it happens a lot. Let's be honest.
Yeah.
Most of the time, the child is abused by someone who's a family member, and often the father. As we come to the conclusion of tonight's show, we should say the one statistic we haven't reported, and we usually do say,
mm-hmm.
is it's only 7% of the time that a child, according to the figures the government keeps, is assaulted by a complete stranger. 93% of the time, it's at the hands of someone they're supposed to be able to know, love, or trust. And two-thirds of that, it's a family member, a direct family member, or a at-large family member, an uncle or a grandfather or mom's new boyfriend. Sorry?
Extended family.
Mm-hmm.
Extended
yeah.
family member. Mm-hmm. But one-third of the time, it is an immediate family member, like a brother or a
mm-hmm.
father. Or a mother,
mm-hmm.
Who is the abuser. So a lot of kids are being abused by either their immediate family or the second, third, by the extended family. You know, it's
mm-hmm.
just, there's no way to look at this with any kind of rosiness. No matter which way you look at it, the statistics are horrifying. They're
right.
Shocking. And they should be a wake-up call. and about our need to take action now and not wait any longer.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
All right. We have 5 minutes left, so I guess I give each of us an opportunity to go around the horn and say any final thoughts. Jay Tao, thank you so much for being with the show. Look up Jay Tao's website at alttherapist.org with two T's. You'll find there that he does counseling and coaching, life coaching, and he's a certified sex therapist for his local area, which is Fort Lauderdale, but also over the internet by use of Skype. And Jay Tao is also available for you to contact if you want to find a psychologist or a therapist or a recovery group near you. He may be a resource for that because he has such excellent contacts all over the country, and he offers this as a service to anyone who calls him. He'll give you two or three people that look good to him that you should go to interview and find out if they're a good fit. Well, that's a terrific service that we could not offer, except Jay is doing that for us through us, and we're very grateful.
Mm-hmm.
Jay, any final thoughts for tonight?
It's been a pleasure being here, and I hope everybody has a wonderful week.
Thanks so much for being with us again. Jay is with us every Sunday night, and you can always look him up at alttherapist.org. MJ Goins is a registered nurse, has been one for 24 decades, a long time.
What was that?
She currently serves as the shift supervisor at the county hospital where she lives in rural Ohio, and as such, she works nighttime. She's the night shift supervisor. And she comes home every morning, and she puts together a couple of emails for me. I mean, 7 days a week she does this, because 7 days a week we update our websites. The emails she composes and sends on to me are the result of the research that she does about the topics that she knows we're interested in, both for the community policing website, which are usually issues of public safety, and for the adult survivors of child abuse website, which are usually articles about issues of child abuse and childhood trauma and the recovery from it. She then sends those to me. I turn them into web pages, and every morning our websites are fresh with new information, and those are the articles that we compile together for Sunday night's topics and we've been using for tonight's show. So I want to thank MJ very much for her ongoing participation for over 10 years now. She's been working with me, and thank you so much, MJ. Your final thoughts for you?
You're very welcome, and you better watch what you're saying.
Uh-oh, what did you do now?
You know you have an important birthday coming up this month, and I could rat you out.
Uh-huh. I think I even know what day.
Uh-huh. I know for sure what day.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I don't mind people knowing. I'm 59 years old. I'll be 60, joining the rest of you in your 60th decade.
Ah, yes.
Listen to him.
It's okay. It doesn't change you a bit.
No, March 26th.
It doesn't.
So thank you very much for bringing that up, MJ.
Oh, you're very welcome. My pleasure, believe me.
All right, and finally, last but not least, of course, Carol V. Levine. Carol is the co-host of our Monday to Friday shows, and she shares the responsibility with me for the shows we do each night at 8 o'clock, Monday to Friday, where we either do open mic shows or open topic shows, where it doesn't matter what we don't pre-plan ahead of time what we're going to talk about. In fact, we invite you, the community member, to call in and suggest what it is you'd like to hear about. You can make comments about what you've heard us talk about. You can ask questions. You can talk about yourself and so forth. And Carol, like myself, has long-term recovery behind her. She's over 30 years in recovery. Mm-hmm. And she's very active in her community in Northwest New Jersey and Eastern Pennsylvania. Carol, final thoughts?
Oh, we had a good show as usual. It was a very thoughtful kind of show. We did a lot of thinking about what we were talking about, and I like that. Everyone out there, you know, child abuse is an epidemic, so I hope that you get a lot from these shows and become proactive. See you tomorrow.
Thanks very much, Carol. And, of course, she's the author of Panic Child, the harrowing true story of sexual abuse and neglect. It's available everywhere, including Amazon. My name is Bill Murray. I founded these organizations, and I'm delighted to call this the mission of the rest of my life, probably, to work on these issues. And I am very, very happy and appreciative that there's so many people that now follow us and so many volunteers, and we need even more. So if you have some time and some talent and you want to be a part of something significant, let us know. We'll find something for you to do. In the meantime, join us again tomorrow night for an open mic show with Carol, where Carol and I will lead the discussion, and you can tell us what it is that you want to talk about. Thanks to Carol, MJ, Jay, and Chris in the chat room. May God bless you, God bless America, and God bless adult survivors of child abuse.
Love Talk Radio.